session number 20259, Reel 5.
Jim Benz, Reel 5.
And they're preceded by MPs. And big commotion, everybody brought up to attention, and the general came in, and he kind of just stopped and talked to one or two people on the way down, sort of thing, you know. And down where the petition was, he did whatever he was doing, you know. Sort of got a little sort of guard there, and somebody had a bugle that played a tune, and taps, or I don't know what it was, but he'd done what he had to do, and he came out again. And then this top sergeant came up and he said, right, all you limeys, either take a pace forward, or if you're on your bed, sit up in your beds and one thing or another. And he came along and I'm stood there with the bandages on, and he came up to me and whatever he pinned on my chest, he took it off. And anyway, I asked my man who was looking after me, I said, you know, what's this? He said, oh, he says, that's a purple star. He said, if you know, everybody who comes in here gets wounded, get a purple star, you see. He said, but your lime is not allowed to wear them. So he said, we take them off. I said, why did they give you them in the first place? He said, well, the man in charge of the MASH hospital, the brigadier or whatever he is, you know, top man of the surgeons sort of things, or his representative, he says, he'll go and see this general and say, look, we've got all these American boys here, and we're short of this, and we're short of that, and we're short of this and that. He said, and he'll go back and he'll go back to Congress and say, ah, American boys are out there and they ain't got this and they ain't got that. He said, and the next thing you know, there'll be a shipload or an airplane load of it all come in. Well, I mean, they already get everything free. They get, when you go in there, you get packets of you get shaving foam and razor blades and soap and toothbrush and toothpaste. They get these with the rations. And then they've got the latest tunes on playing on different sort of machines, and sort of in the compound where the walking wounded all go and have the meals over there, is they've got great big popcorn machines. You know, you just get a packet and you got one of the machines and you throw them in and put the perspex lid on it and press a button and it heats up and whizzes round, and then the next thing you get the syrup to pour on them. And And at the top end is a bloke behind the counter, and they've got every kind of ice cream you want. I mean, what other comforts do they want? And I mean, the clothing, you know, I mean, they can get a pair of socks and take them off and put a new pair on. They wouldn't, you know, don't bother to wash them. Well, that's we have to sign for our socks. And if you haven't got a chance to get them, tell me, wash, you keep them on till the time you can get them off. And besides, you can't change them in winter. It'd be frostbite in no time. And then from there, I'm back to join the battalion, back in the line. And we travelled. We then had a whole lot of trucks drawn up, which were New Zealand, and New Zealand drivers. And they were trucks that didn't do the like old American trucks. They didn't have a door on the front. It was just metal sort of thing with a U thing out so you can step into the driving thing, but it had a canopy over the back. And we went in there, and it was the middle of winter, and I think we drove. Well, we couldn't go very fast. I think 20, 30 miles top speed. We're going round and round these hills and one thing or another. And after about hour and a half, they'd stop for everybody to get out. Well, the thing is, people were falling out the back of the lorries because they were all frozen up. And you know, you're trying your best to try and stamp your feet to get warm. You've got your hand, you've got gloves on, wristlets. The sort of winter clothing that we had, if we start with a basic pair of underpants, a string vest, then we had what they call long johns, which were white. On top of that, we had nigger browns, which was a fleecy sort of thing. Then you had your combat trousers on top of that. A string vest, an ordinary vest, a shirt, a pullover, another big tie-up pullover, your combat jacket, and a parka with a hood over the top. You had wristlets up to your elbows, mittens on top of those, khaki gloves on top of that, and your big full-size mittens on that, which was a T-fingers, your trigger finger was loose, and a thumb. So the thing. And the other thing about having all this sort of gear on, that we used all TLT rifles, and the trigger guards had to be taken off, because your finger wouldn't fit into the trigger guard to be able to pull the trigger, because you got all this equipment on. And I mean, if you took the equipment off and tried to do it, well, you'd be frozen, you know. Your hands would freeze to the weapon anyway. And so we had all this gear on, and I say, we jump off these lorries, and we got inner soles in your boots, and you got all these different socks on, and kind of a fiberglass inner sole, so that you've put, it's not directly in touch with your, with the rubber of your boots, and sort of things. But still, you were out of there, you know. What with your ears hurting, of course your lips, and anybody who had beards or anything, of course they're all frozen up, and you have to, you know, you can't keep putting a, if you put a scarf over your face, then of course breathing through the scarf, then it'll form a solid block of ice on the back, and you won't be able to breathe. So because you have to take that off and just try and bear the cold as you can, you know, keep your face out from the wind, and jump up and down for about a quarter of an hour and try and get in and say, right, all aboard again. You get aboard and then off we go to another one. And we finished up. We were moving back to what they call Kansas lines. And it was going, it was coming to the time that all the talks were going on at Panmunjom. The little general had been there, Brown, the American one, he'd been killed in a jeep accident. And the man who came over was Mark Clark. And of course, by that time, President Truman had got Eisenhower. And the bloke who said, I shall return to
McCarthy
got rid of him, because MacArthur actually wanted to drop the atomic bomb. And of course, we weren't very happy about that, because he said, you know, he's going to drop it just over the Yala River and sort of thing, so we would have copped everything that was coming back. And I mean, this, you can see what had happened to the ones that dropped in Japan. Well, these are going to be a lot bigger than that. And, you know, he was a big man that, you know, was going to do this. And Truman said, oh, no, no, no. And they got rid of him, and Mark Clark came out. And of course, the negotiations went on and sort of things, and they keep falling down. And there used to be two searchlights that used to shine over Panmunjom, a red one and a green one. If the red one was on, the war was still on. If the green one was on, if the red and the green was on, the talks had stopped, but the war was still on. If it come to a time where there was no red and just a green on its own, the war would have been over. Well, it was never over. It was never. It was just a ceasefire. The war never ended. It's still a ceasefire today. And there's a demarcation zone where the hook is and all this, that and the other. Of course, that's the line that goes right through there. And we came out of the line to a rest camp, and the engineers had rigged up some open-air showers, and they got big 40-gallon drums and got all this hot water boiling up and one thing and another, and kind of rigged some pipes on with a shower head on the top, and, you know, get under it first and run out straight away because it was really hot, get them, pour some old cold water in it, and they got a change of clothing, which was great, because in the winter time, the thing was, you couldn't get washed, because, well, if you managed to freeze any water, either you wanted it for yourself or sort of things, you couldn't shave, anything like that. And all you used to do, you got tins of louse powder and just open your neck of your jumper and your shirt and shook all the louse powder down there. And, you know, and it was very much like the First World War. Well, the whole thing about that sort of situation, it was the First World War, trench warfare and everything like that, and the bombardment, so you just had to sit there and take it, you know. I mean, they talk about shell shock, but then you've got to, that's what it is. You can't all go down with shell shock and sort of things, and of course you don't want to break in front of your mates, and of course you think, you know, well, I'm here, and you know, they're my mates, and some good mates that I've lost, and you know, they wouldn't take too happy to me being, you know, get out of the way, sort of thing. So you kind of chivvied each other up, you know, have another fag or something like that. I mean, the sort of the trench, the tunnels that they dug, sort of thing. I managed to avoid the sort of the tunnels when it come to the thing, when it come to blowing the ends in. But all the lads, but I know from the diggings and one thing and another, of course, when they went into the thing, when the bombardment came down, I mean, it was very continuous. The bombardment was coming down, 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 and that built up over 10 days before the actual battle started, this bombardment from chinks and things. But when it came to the height of the battle, Baron Emmett, who was our colonel of D Company, captain he was then, sorry, of D Company, and there were so many chinks on top of the hook and one thing like that, he called even our own divisional artillery to be dropped on the hook. But he gave everybody time to get near enough to get into the tunnels and sort of things. Well, during the bombardment, the tunnels were in use because people were sheltering in there. And of course, they rigged up electric lights. The engineers have got some electric lights going. But of course, all you've got is a few shells down, the bloody wires have gone and things like that. So they went out. Then comes the candles. So you've got the candles on there. Well, that's all right for the time, but then with this continual bombardment, one shell will come in and make kind of a hole, and then you get another one will drop in the same one. It's getting nearer to the heads on the tunnels, you know, or the bunkers, wherever you are. And if it's sort of the sand is coming out of the sandbags, because that's filtering through there, the candles are going. But of course they're using the oxygen up as well, and all the sand's coming down, and people are going up, kind of tingling. You can't get out there, and you can't do this. So the candles have to go out. Well, then it's darkness, you know, and all the thing. You know, somebody might have a radio going, and it's lucky that, you know, they've got the batteries on the 88 sets. But I mean, that was a terrible radio, the 88 batteries. Used to go out on patrols. I mean, especially in winter, but lots of batteries are useless. The cold's got to them. There's not enough power, and the handsets, and there's so much mush coming in on there. You know, you can hear the chinkies yapping up something and one thing and another. Well, if they're on the line, start yapping, you know something's happening. You know, and you try and get this information back, and the batteries are gone. Just sling them. Come back, you know, if you could near to the end of your patrols, at least you could get back with the information still, as of then, what's happening, sort of thing, even though you couldn't get it back on the phone. But I mean, they only want the information if something is actually on the move coming in, so they've got plenty of warning to what's going to happen to the people on the ground, you know, prepared for this. The division artillery will be on standby, besides the battalion ones and everything, and everybody be on the alert and things. But there's a sort of thing that when we were saying about the louse powder, of course, when we got to these baths and you took your gear off and it was the inside of your string vest and but we're all matted up with all this louse powder. Oh, it's like, I mean, bees, honey sort of come, but it was hard. And we chucked all the gear, all the clothes on one side and got new stuff. And they'd rigged up some drinking dens, you know, like a marquee with built a bar inside it. And the engineers and the assault pioneers had done that for us, and kind of put some little paintings on, you know, the chinks or lads with the in combat gear. So then we got the beers, and then the nappy come up, got the nappy up. And of course the nappy people wore uniform as well, because if you come to an overrun and they got captured and they were wearing civilian clothes, because the Chinese say, oh well, you know, here we've got what do you call it,
spies
spies and things like that. So So they wore uniform as well, did the Naffy men. And while we were at the line there, of course, we got the old searchlight went up and sort of, you know, there was peace. Yeah, so we just waited about for a bit and one thing and another. And of course, the usual thing, you know, put that light out. Oh, no, it's a peace, you know. Shining the light up in the air, you know. There was fires, we got fires going out in the open, and we got extra rations coming from somewhere and everything. So the next thing was that everybody, we all had to withdraw from the area, but before we did, we had to go in and kind of disarm all take all the guns out and disarm all the different sort of things that we got there, because there was plenty of grenades already primed in little holes near the sandbags and along trenches and things like that. So all them had to be taken out and withdraw behind the line to a certain area, and then kind of the battalion come back onto its sort of regimental sort of things, all lined up, the parades and things, and we had a little service there, and then we had another bigger service out down at Poussin Cemetery, and they give us time to go around and have a look at the graves and kind of anybody who had cameras take photographs and all that sort of the lads. And then we were on the boat called the Astoria. And our next port of call was Gibraltar.
When you were in hospital after being injured first time in Japan, when you went to Japan, what treatment did you get there?
What
treatment?
Oh, it was first class treatment. And it was all Queen Anne's Royal Army Nursing Corps that was out there. You know, it's like any military hospital, you know, we've got the matron in charge and one thing and another, and they're all very nice to you and sort of things, you know. I think the nurses and the, especially the sisters and one thing another, are really charming to you. You know, we've been out living rough with the lads in the bunkers and whatnot, and we've got nice looking women and got lipstick on and things like that and sort of thing. So if you do feel discomfort or aches and pains and whatnot, you try not to show it, but you could say to the nurse, you know, if I had a shot or something, I'd feel a bit more comfortable, sort of thing. But you don't crib about aches and pains, because there's a lot of lads in there that are worse than you, and a lot of them are not going to come out again.
How do you feel now about having served in Korea?
Well, it's hard to say, you know. It's you know what you see. We're out there, and everybody says to themselves, you know, what am I doing out here all this way? Well, of course, the Chinkies used to have their propaganda things going, and they used to send them over, and they used to kind of feed us as well, and saying, you know, what are you fighting for the Yanks for, and all this, that, and the other, and you know, put your arms down and come across here. And used to send leaflets over to prisoner of war, you know, playing chess and having a beer and all sorts of things. But
did you believe the propaganda?
No, it wasn't. Nobody ever sort of put the rifle down and walked over there. They knew as soon as, you know, they wouldn't start walking over that way. Let's say the Chinkies would shoot them. Yep. I mean, you know, patronage, it didn't, you know, England wasn't involved, and our families weren't involved, and one thing or another. It always seemed to be the Americans, you know, that they were top dogs. I mean, we were just helping them. It's the way the Americans look at it, you know, we're just helping them. We were fighting a bloody war for them, for God's sake. We were losing men, you know, but sort of thing. But then I've got a book here with a lot of different sort of propaganda things in it, and sort of, you know, and the Chinks used to kind of play on it, you know, saying, you know, the Americans are using you as a tool and sort of thing. They're not interested in what you want and what you don't want. And
what was your attitude towards the enemy?
Up to not seeing them, sort of thing, it was just somebody out there. But then when it come to a skirmish and you saw how vicious it could be in mounting another, well, it was you or them. You know, you couldn't say, oh, you know, hold on a minute, you know, I know you're being treated rough and your people are starving and this, that and the other. That didn't make any difference. It was you or them. And the thing was that the British regiments kind of fought on their own. The Americans fought on that side. We did join up for times with what we call Commonwealth Force, because we were in Commonwealth Div, which was Canadian, New Zealand, Australian, Indian, and of course us. But there was other countries that were in there, but with the Americans, like the Belgians, some Norwegians, Dutch, because they were formed into regiments with the Americans, who carried American dib signs and had American weapons and sort of things. But, you know, I mean, we kind of looked on the Chinkies as the little fellas and things, but they were cruel sort of people. But then they live a cruel life. I mean, the Chinese and the Koreans, they're fighting what they call, it's a three man, everything's done in threes. Each group of people, there's three people, two to watch one to watch two. Wherever one goes, the other two go. Whatever when one stops to do, the other two stop to do. You know, and it's all like that. And that's how they control them. The people that are driving them are at the back. When the troops are when they're coming in, you know, it depends. You can tell, if you're going out on patrol and you suddenly come to a skirmish or one thing or another, and you've got one or two of them, you're taking prisoner, or the dead ones, and you bring them back. You know they're coming to stay because they've got the chopsticks with them. And the funny thing is, all the ones at the front seem to be the ones that have got the blooming jugs with the chumps, you know. And the blooming, they're the ones that are shouting and carrying the flags and sort of things, you know. And they'll go down, you know, but the ones at the back ain't got a rifle. When one drops, he gets that rifle, but he keeps running as well. And they're all, you know, all in threes, but they're all together. And the people at the back are controlling all these threes, you know, telling them where to go, onward, and this, that and the other. You know, if you come to barbed wire and whatnot, the front rank's supposed to just come in, lie down there and let them all walk over him. If he's dead before he lies down there, that'd be better for him, I suppose, because he's never going to ever get off again.
How did you feel about leaving Korea?
Oh, happy. Happy. Great to be going back, you know. And yet at the same time, I felt sorry for the little sort of Koreans that we had on our side, that because the South Koreans, the Americans took the best of the fighting force of the South Koreans and called them the Korean Army, the CATCOMs. They were called the CATCOMs, they got the best. The ones that were left behind were the sort of farmers and slow-witted, wouldn't be fair to say slow-witted, just that they had a slower pace of life, sort of thing. You would have people who worked in the paddy fields and this, that and the other. Well, they came and we had them as ammo carriers and things like that and stores, because, I mean, they have an A-frame that they could get, I mean, three boxes of ammo on there that take two of our men to get one box up a hill. And all they've got is a little wooden A-frame and a stick, and the trousers are always... Go to there, you know, boots on. And they climb up them hills, and they'd go up there with a handful of food, knife, anything like that. But then they were told by Sigmund Rhee to come and you know, help. You know, everybody's got to help to free your own sort of country. And they came, and then towards when they've been with us quite a bit and one thing and another, we actually started adopting them into the regiments because we give them a uniform and they give us our cap badge and sort of things like that. And it was in there, and there was sort of they all got the they knew our names, we knew them, but a lot of them have the same sort of names, and they all have three names. I mean, the two that I used to have had a Kim Yui Sang. And the other one was called Kim Yui Sang OK. You see, at first when it was going to be Kim Yui Sang 1 and Kim Yui Sang 2. But 1 and 2, for how it was pronounced to them, they couldn't really work that out. But they knew Kim Yui Sang me, Kim Yui Sang him, OK. So it was always called OK, you know. So he'd say, shout Kim Yui Sang OK, and sort of things. And they were there, and then they learned a little bit of English and sort of things. But this Kim Yui Sang, the first one, he was the one for going round all the trenches collecting soap. Collecting soap, and he'd have his little bag and he'd have all this soap. And then after, you know, so many days and sort of thing, he'd disappear. He'd gone. And what he'd do, he'd come back, and he'd come back with some sake wine or something like that. You were told not to drink it. Well, it was in certain places that it was sort of, they say it makes you go blind, this, that and the other. But, I mean, what they'd drink wouldn't be what they tried to give us, but we'd have what he'd drink, you know. He used to do, and what he used to do, he'd go down to the washing women, you see, and give them all the soap. Because they used to do all the washing down, you know, at the river and things like that. And you could get your gear done there. Because there was no good sending it down to the laundry, you never knew when it would get back. Unless the QM came up and said, right, change your clobber, come down to the wagon, put your hand in, you'll get back. So of course, the things always used to be, you know, vest and socks and underpants were the first three things that you wanted. I mean, socks were terrible because, I mean, in the winter it's freezing, in the summer it's really boiling. And then you've got all these sort of different things that happen in sort of the winter time was bugs, you know, and rats. You get rats in the bunk as well. I mean, if you build a bunker and you build anything like that, well, of course you tunnel into their sort of territory and they get in your bunker. But you mustn't kill them. You can try and chew them out. But if you kill them and the body goes cold, of course you've got these little mites on. And of course, if the body goes cold, that'll leave and jump on the next one. And if you got bit by that, you got Tsongo fever, which was a deadly sort of fever. You haven't got much chance of getting it done. And now, of course, in the summertime, we've got snakes. And they were poisonous. So things, I remember going out on a patrol in the summer. And just before you go on the patrol, you go down to the head bunker at forward command post and you get all your information there and one thing another. And off you go on your patrol and come back and report in. But on the way down to patrol, I was leading along a trench, and there was a snake that had come over the top and he'd come down the side of the trench and he was trying to get across the other side. And he just couldn't make it. So what he does is he eases himself a bit further down the trench this way so he's got a bit more body to get over. But I wanted to go through with them. We had to be at the command post at a certain time. And so I shouted out, you know, whoever's on the back there has got a machete. Somebody's always got a machete on the patrol because they might need it for something. So anyway, they passed the machete up. And I took a swipe at the snake and run through. But by the time I turned round, I missed the snake because the snake must have known that was all this row going on. And he couldn't get across there quick enough, so he decided to go back. He slid up and gone off that way. But then, of course, a few of the lads had got these sort of ideas from the Americans, I think, during the summer. Oh, nice big snake, kill them, string them, and then passing the skin out on a board. And they were told that if you get salt and rub it in, it cures them, you know, and they'll leave it out in the sun to dry. Hello, Nick.